watching Dr. Dobbs Tech Netcast.
I'm Fred. I work at Apple in the CoreOS group, and mostly I spend my time working on the BSD part of the system. I spend also a lot of time talking to other groups at Apple in how to leverage the BSD functionality in the higher level APIs and so on. So what I'm going to talk about today is first I'll give you a little bit of background on basically stuff you already know, but is useful to just put the rest of the stuff into context. And then the majority of the talk is going to be, I'm going to present sort of a problem that we ran into, some examples of solutions that we came up with, and then maybe tell you which one we picked. And hopefully we'll find that we didn't make too many bad calls. There are four areas that I picked. Certainly there's a lot of material to cover, but there's only an hour and change to talk about them. File systems are easy fodder for incompatibility issues between how macOS and Unix expects things to work. So there'll be a lot of material there. I'll also talk about files as opposed to file systems, and not the data in the files per se, but how users interact with, manage, and use files on the various systems. It's actually a fairly different thing. And we'll also talk about the inclusion of support for multiple users in macOS, which is a relatively new concept, and is far more fundamental in the Unix world than it ever has been in macOS. And although it's not my area, I'll talk a little bit about Classic because I think it's pretty interesting stuff. And after talking to one of the engineers there, he gave me some neat stuff to talk about. So we'll start with a little bit of background. macOS, as we all know, is sort of designed around the idea of having the best possible user experience. You know, it's got this graphical user interface. It's got very tight integration with the hardware we make. We're one of the last companies around, certainly in the mass market area, that's actually selling the whole widget, where we sell the design, build, sell the hardware with the software that we also design and build. Clearly Sun's in that market, but in a different space. And in the Linux world, we're seeing some of that, in the BSD world as well now. But in the mass market, Apple's sort of one of the few guys left there. Aside from the user experience, sort of everything else was secondary in macOS. It's all about being a personal computer. You've got one computer, you've got one user. Only one computer, only one user. And the whole thing was designed around that idea of, this is my computer, it's going to be inexpensive, it's going to be easy to use, I'm going to have zero administration overhead because I don't have an IS department at home. And it's going to be a very simple thing. It's the kind of computer you give to your mom. On the Unix side, we've got a very different sort of historical background. Unix was designed around sort of engineering goals. It was sort of the first open source thing, although it wasn't free. You know, you got the source code with the system, and places like Cal Berkeley just jumped on that because you could do a lot of experimentation, you could add and extend things, and you could innovate in a lot of cool ways. You can, in fact, make a system that was better than the one that came with the computer in the first place. One of the interesting things about those computers as opposed to the personal computers, well, these computers were pretty expensive. And if you go to Professor McCusick's talk about the history of BSD, if you haven't been, you should, they actually traded off an elevator at Berkeley for a computer. And that's a lot of dollars. And when you spend that much money on a computer, you're going to want to get as much bang for that buck as possible. So you get a different sort of set of priorities. One is that this computer needs to be busy all the time. There's got to be people always using it because you have to amortize the cost of the machine. And scheduling one user at a time is A, difficult, and B, highly inefficient. So one of the very early goals of the systems that ran on these computers was to enable multiple users to use the machine simultaneously. And because crashes are very expensive and downtime just bums everyone out, you really want a system that's very robust and that protects users from each other, that protects the processes that one guy's running from processes that another guy's running. This was not a goal in the macOS where you could sort of trust your vendors to give you quality software because the users aren't developing their own things, and you could expect that apps are going to behave fairly well. Whereas in this very experimental world, you're going to have a lot of things that are going to perhaps be buggy, and you don't want some guy scribbling all over your program's memory. So in going forward with macOS, we've realized that macOS has a lot of cool features that we like, but it's also got a lot of baggage attached to it due to the assumptions that we made about the machines back in 1984 and before then, I mean, these are computers that ran at 10 megahertz or so, at 128K of RAM, and pretty much just spent all of their energy putting this UI up. A lot of those assumptions are very different today. RAM is very cheap now, relatively, and you can just use it willy-nilly. And that really changes the dynamic of how a system should operate. And a lot of the assumptions we made early on were thinking maybe weren't so good. On the other hand, Unix is pretty strong in exactly those areas where macOS wasn't, although it leaves a little bit to desire in the UI space. So, you know, we make this observation, and then we go to our smart people at the company, that's marketing, and they come up with, well, you keep the good stuff and you toss out the bad stuff. And that's what macOS 10 needs to be. And in fact, that's what we're building. We're starting with a BSD core operating system, which we call Darwin. It's basically a full BSD stack. At the top, we've got a new and improved spiffy Macintosh user experience, which we call Aqua. And that's not just a theme. It is a look and feel, but it's also behavioral specifications for how controls work, how applications behave when you do certain things to them, and how events are handled from the user. And then so somewhere in the middle, there's got to be a whole bunch of magic that happens. And it turns out that most of our energy is actually spent there. We don't want to fiddle around too much with how BSD behaves, because if we change that, then we sort of fall out of the POSIX space and we run into all sorts of problems importing things from that area. We don't want to change how macOS applications expect the system to work, because we've got 20 million customers, or that's when I started at Apple, and I assume we've got more now. And they've got thousands of applications they want to keep running. So we don't want to change those things. So here's a sort of blown up picture of the architecture behind macOS 10. If you were at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, you've probably seen this a lot. Darwin's at the bottom. We've got a layer we call the core services, which is things like the core foundation library, which is sort of a beefed up, everything Clib should have been. And things like NetInfo and system services like that live in there. We've got application services, which is, Quartz is our drawing model and our Windows Server implementation. OpenGL is our 3D story. QuickTime is our time-based media story. We've got an environment called Classic, which runs legacy applications, because we don't want our customers to have to buy new things necessarily. They should be able to take their existing programs and make those work. Those applications get the old look and feel, which is called Platinum for macOS 9. And then we've got two APIs, one called Carbon, which is basically the Mac toolbox stripped down so that all the things that prevented it from working on a multi-threaded, preemptive, modern OS were taken out. It's a reduced version of macOS API. Some functions were modified a little bit. Mostly it was removable of dead and unused API. And that gives our current developer customers an opportunity to port to the new system without having to do an inordinate amount of work. Cocoa is what used to be OpenStep, which is what used to be NextStep, and is an object-oriented API, very popular with the people who use it. I'm a big fan of it. You can program in it using Objective-C or Java, and it's very easy, very fast development. And those two environment, or those two APIs feature the Aqua user experience. And, of course, there's the BSD system, which we usually leave out of this picture, but since this is Unix, I figure we can leave it there. And of course, BSD supports curses, which is sort of the cocoa of the command line. Some problem areas that we ran into in making all of this work. Again, most of these are in the middle, but we'll start with the file systems, which got a lot of areas to talk about there. The file systems supported in macOS 9 include HFS, HFS Plus, ISO, and DOS. HFS Plus is sort of a legacy API, legacy file system. HFS Plus is our sort of new and spiffy thing, and we're deprecating HFS in macOS 10, and we're adding to the file system list UFS and NFS. We don't have DOS right now, but I'm sure that's not too hard to add, and there's a lot of potential for new things like AFS and other things that are in the open source world that we could bring over. One of the sort of easy things to pick on is the case sensitivity issue. We're now booting and rooting our system. In fact, this presentation is running on macOS 10, and there's no UFS partitions here. It's all HFS Plus. And HFS Plus is case insensitive. And when we first thought about this, a lot of us thought, you know, well, all hell's going to break loose now. Everything's going to break. Nothing's going to really work too well. And I was sort of one of the people that thought it would be a big crisis. It turns out it wasn't too bad. The file systems guys just got it working, and they didn't really need a whole help from me or many other people in order to get it to happen. The number of cases where there are actual file name collisions is thankfully low. And that's actually a good thing. I mean, if you're actually changing file names just by case, you're probably doing something wrong anyway. But, you know, we ran into a couple of them. User bin mail, capital M versus little m. That came up. TCL likes to install a bunch of man pages with case variant names of libc API, which was rather annoying. I fixed that. But they were pretty small. And the fixes were trivial. And, you know, they were actually all good fixes, it turns out. Ports to Windows, courtesy of Cygnus and other people, actually helped on some of this stuff because they ran into the issues of case-insensitive file systems already. The only thing that still bites us is we build the system on UFS because there's a fair bit of Unix stuff that still won't compile on a case-insensitive file system, Perl being a notorious one. It uses little makefile and big makefile, and if you've ever used Perl's configure, it's not a joy to work with. But the system works just fine on HFS Plus. Another thing is the path separator is different. HFS expects colons. UFS uses slashes. The BSD kernel, of course, uses slashes internally. And the BSD libraries also use slashes. Cocoa follows suit because it always was living on BSD, with the exception of the OpenStep on Windows, which used backslash. And Carbon expects a colon. So that's rather confusing because different people expect different things. Importantly, on disk, it doesn't matter too much except that you can't have a slash in a file name on UFS. The actual slashes aren't used to separate things on disk, but you can't have them in a file name because it would be problematic when you actually got it up into the kernel. So I'll run you through an example of a file. Say you've got a file called IOKit Overview, and since maybe it's on... You didn't set the file type, so you had .rtf at the end. But there's a slash in there. And on disk, you've got a slash in the file name. This is an HFS plus file. So when a user opens this, the kernel is going to pull it out, and it's going to convert. By the time it gets to the VFS layer, it's going to be a colon. And the HFS file system is doing that for you. UFS, of course, wouldn't have to do this translation, but HFS does. The kernel just passes that up to the BSD libraries because they're happy to get the slash out. And Coco, which sits on top of BSD, also does that. Carbon, however, gets the stuff from BSD, and then it converts it back. And I can show you an example of that, if this all works out. Here's the Finder, and I'll go to my home directory here, and there's the file IOKit Overview. And when you open that same file up in the terminal, you can list it out, and you see there's a colon there. So there's a little bit of confusion from the user experience, because the BSD stuff sees a colon, the Carbon stuff sees a slash, and actually if you open the file up, you bring up the open panel on a Cocoa app, you'll see a colon. So it's a little bit of confusion there, but I think it's something we can live with, and it tends to work fairly well. One of the features of HFS Plus is that it has this thing called file IDs. And file IDs are basically like inodes, although inodes aren't quite like file IDs. But a file ID is like a persistent file handle. You can open a file, you get its ID, and if you squirrel it away somewhere, you can actually quit your app and reopen the file just using that ID. And you don't have to go through the whole business of parsing paths and so on. So it's a little bit faster. But more interesting, it's also a bit more robust in that the user can then move the file around anywhere and you'll still find it. And aliases, which are like symbolic links in macOS, use that. And they store the path. And if they can't find the file at the path, they'll check out the file ID. And these are processed at the Carbon layer, not in the kernel, like symbolic links are. Unfortunately, they're not available outside of HFS Plus, so if you're on a UFS file system, you're not going to get that. And that's a problem for Carbon because the API uses these things and exports them. So in Carbon, they actually synthesize these things on UFS and NFS file systems, although they don't persist across a reboot like they would on HFS Plus. Hard links were fun. They're not supported in the HFS Plus file format at all, so that's a bit problematic. And initially what we did is we just return e.sup whenever somebody tries to create one of these things. That breaks a couple of things. Some makefiles like to make hard links. Gunzip is a hard link to gzip, for example. And I could fix that easily enough by making that a symbolic link, but then I don't know how easy it would be to get people to accept that sort of patch just for the sake of HFS Plus. Some software actually breaks. The Debian package installer uses hard links while it's installing things, and fixing that's a little less trivial. And we use that in Darwin, so it's a little bit relevant. The other option is to cheat and make symlinks instead of hard links, but that makes me, at least, rather uncomfortable, because the problem there is, while it does fix the majority of the cases in that the behavior tends to work out, it bypasses error recovery. So if I'm creating a hard link, I want to know that it's not possible to create a hard link, and I'll do something intelligent. But if the system pretends that it created a hard link when actually it created a symbolic link, and then later I break because I had assumed it was a hard link, that sort of thing is much harder to debug. So I was really adamant against that idea. What we ended up doing is faking it. In the kernel, we'll create, when you create a hard link to a file, the target file actually gets moved away somewhere hidden, and we create an alias of the carbon variety on disk. But these aliases are special in that they're actually parsed by the kernel. So the behavior in the end is actually exactly that of hard links, in that from the user space perspective, it all looks exactly like a hard link, it behaves like a hard link, it gets manipulated like a hard link. But the performance of it is a little slower than it would be on UFS. In fact, it's rather like a symbolic link, really. And then if you boot into macOS or macOS 9, or you look at the file in Classic, you'll see a sort of broken-looking alias file. So it's a little less efficient, but it works, and it supports the software that needed it, which was really what we were after. We don't encourage people to create hard links on the system. They have a little weirdness to them anyway. Even in the Unix space, some people think that they could be made to go away, but that's sort of where we're at right now there. Complex files are another issue. In HFS Plus, you can have a file with two data streams, a resource fork and a data fork. HFS Plus isn't unique here. UDF, which is used on DVDs, also supports named attributes, which are arbitrary named attributes on any file or directory, for that matter. NFSV4 is likely to do that as well. And so we need some sort of way of getting to that data. But there's also the question of how you what happens when you actually open a file. These things, of course, are not supported in standard Unix or traditional Unix formats. But when you open a file, say you want to CP a file A to file B, well, you want to preserve all of the data. So somehow you've got to combine the resource fork and the data fork together so that CP gets all of the data and then puts it into the right target file. So one solution is in the kernel, we could actually encode files as apple double. And that actually works out rather nicely for CP and tar, but it makes everyone else unhappy, because if you've got a C file and you opened it up in MetroWorks, and so that adds a resource fork with some information about maybe your coloring preferences or window position for the editor, you're going to open that up in Emacs, and you're going to see some apple double turd at the top, and then you're going to see your C file, and then you're going to see some weird stuff at the bottom, maybe. And that's not really desirable. The compiler won't like that. And, of course, when you try to mmap something like that, then you've got a really interesting problem, because some of that data is synthesized, so it's really read-only, whereas the rest of it is actually read-write. So that could be pretty ugly. So we tossed that idea out. Another possibility is to actually use two separate files. We didn't really dive too deeply into that. It's similar to what people do with NetAttack and CAP, which are AppleShare implementations on Unix, in that you'll put the resource fork in a separate file. So you know the kernel could actually export a couple of files out to the system. The problem there is that you've got two objects which are really one object. And say if you move one file, the other one needs to follow it. You can actually make all of that work, but it seems a little iffy. And what do you do if you create the resource file? Do you want to create a resource or what? We don't. You know, it gets a little strange. And plus, you're overloading the namespace a bit, which can be problematic. So what we've decided to do is actually the open system call will just open the data fork. That sort of does the right behavior for things like Emacs and compiler. It loses data, though, if you copy file A to file B, you're going to lose a resource fork because CP doesn't know to actually look for resource data. There is a way to actually open the file data by using an extension to the path, which is you can actually open filename/data or filename/resource. Those are actually not the actual strings, but that's the same idea. And you can get to the resource data that way. It's a little strange. When you stat a file, it does not show as a directory. You can't list it. But you can actually add a little bit extra to the path and get to the other data there. As I said, that works out rather well for Emacs and so on. It's bad for archiving programs, which is actually really unfortunate because, you know, if you tar up something and you want to restore it, you're going to not actually get what you had. Fortunately, rename works, so MV will move the object properly. Of course, if you do it across file systems, it's basically CP again. And internet servers like an FTPD would have to learn about, well, I need to encode this as MAC binary, which is what they do on macOS anyway. Apache could actually utilize the resource fork for storage of metadata, WebDAV being a good example, in that WebDAV has properties that it associates with a document, and you can store those properties in the resource fork as opposed to in a separate DBM file, which is what Greg is doing in moddav today. Another thing is that in macOS, when you delete a file, it fails if the file is open. And that's actually behavior that people depend on in macOS. People even use that as a semaphore mechanism where they'll open a file out while they're doing some operation, and then somebody else will try to delete the file, and if they fail, then they know that the other guy's busy doing something. So we can't really break that. And also, applications don't expect the file to disappear while they have it open. So what we did is add another system call called delete, which basically follows that semantic. And Carbon uses that rather than unlink when it's doing a deletion of a file. Now Unix unlink will still do its thing. So a Unix program can come in underneath a Carbon program and delete the file, and it'll work even if the file is open. We sort of accept that as a okay casualty. It's reasonable to expect that a Carbon developer should be able to handle these errors. But on the other hand, we want to minimize the possibility of exposing bugs in other guys' code because we want the applications to keep working. So this is sort of a fair compromise between them. Permissions are another thing. HFS Plus fortunately supports Unix-style metadata storage. So we can actually store user group and mode bits on disk. That seems like we're looking out here and we're done. Unfortunately, you have to consider that macOS 9 does not. So if you boot into macOS 9, you can bypass all the permissions. That's actually fair. If you're letting your users boot into different OSs, then you're probably going to be disappointed eventually anyway. But more interestingly, if somebody creates new files using macOS 9, and then you give that disk to a macOS 10 user, or you boot into macOS 10 on that machine, these files are going to be modeless. They're not going to be zero. They're going to be modeless entirely. We can actually detect that. So the question is, what do we do in the case of a file that has no mode? Well, we need some sort of default. And that default could be root wheel 755 or 644 for non-directories. But we wanted that to be a bit configurable. So what we've done is, based on the directory on which you've mounted the volume, we actually use that as a mask. So if the directory was mode 755, that's sort of the mask that we're going to use, and we're going to use the user and group that the directory had as the default. That way you can sort of configure that option as you wish. Classic, interestingly enough, actually honors permissions most of the time. When you run the macOS compatibility environment in macOS 10, you will have files that you can or cannot open. And it basically does that using the behavior that you get out of AppleShare remote volumes. This, by the way, goes back to the whole idea of the computer's personal, right? This is my computer, damn it. I can edit any file I want because there is nobody else using it. But now that we've got multiple user support at a very low level, we've got files that could be owned by somebody else. So this is sort of an addition of something. However, macOS did have a notion of file permissions on remote volumes because it's no longer on your computer. And so we sort of extended that down to the local case in Classic. So about files... One of the interesting things is Unix users are very scared of using funny characters in file names. If you stick a backtick in a file name, you get some really funny looks from the Unix guys. And generally, that's because, you know, shell scripts and the like are buggy. In that they, you know, these are valid characters on the file system. You can do it. But if you put spaces or backslashes or other funny things into your file name, it's kind of a pain to type that into your shell. It also tends to break your shell scripts. Our answer to that is that Unix is going to have to adapt on Mac OS X to deal with it, because there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do these things. So it's sort of a common thing I run into a lot is sort of fixing configure scripts and so on to deal with the fact that you might be building onto slash MySpace stuff as opposed to slash temp, which doesn't have space in it. File name extensions in Unix tend to denote the file type. This is also done in Windows. In Mac OS, we use actual metadata on HFS Plus to do that. So in Mac OS X, we're actually allowing both things to work. And that's important because we support UFS as well. And of course, in Unix, paths tend to be treated as API. If you move binsh, you're going to have some interesting problems booting. Whereas on Mac OS, people are used to being able to move things around a lot. So this is sort of a common problem we have. And it turns out in Mac OS X, we're actually still supporting, binsh has to still be there. So we tend to hide some of the Unix directories from the user and try to make it so that they can actually move around the things that they reasonably can. In Mac OS, you don't have any sort of restrictions. If you're allowed to type it in, it's okay. When you download Netscape, it's Netscape Navigator with spaces and a little registered trademark symbol at the end. That's valid. Let's see. File types are stored on disk and not in the file name extension. And you can move things around. Another thing is we have a desktop database, which is sort of like a dynamic registry, which keeps track of what applications are on your disk so that you could always find the app to launch when you open a Photoshop document, for example, regardless of where it is on disk. One of the neat ideas that we got from Next was that you could treat directories as files at the UI level. So you can create a directory that's an application, and in the application wrapper, you can have the binary. You can also have all resources associated with the application, such as the icons for the back arrow and forward arrow on a browser. You can have any libraries that are shared libraries, which are associated only with the app. It can be contained in that bundle. And you could also, you know, maybe if you have some headers that you export a little bit of API from your app, you can also do that. So everything's in one object. And at the UI level, it looks like one thing. You can't really see that it's a directory with stuff. You move it around as one item. It's a really cool encapsulation scheme, and it works really well. We've actually used the same idea for libraries, in that instead of installing the library in userlib and the headers in user include, and maybe if you've got some images somewhere in user share, and who knows what else, we create what's called a framework, and the framework has a headers directory where you put the headers. It's got a resources directory where you put the resources, and it's got a binary, which is the shared library. And it's all in one object. And our compiler knows how to find things in these frameworks. And it's a lot easier to manage and install things that way. First of all, it reduces our need for complex files, which we have on HFS Plus, but don't have on UFS. Mac OS X, actually, when it ships, will have no resource for data anywhere on the system because we want to be able to install it on a UFS volume and have that work as well. But also, very importantly, this scheme simplifies installation. I mean, I'm sure we've all installed software where you need an uninstaller program, or you need an installer program. And that's largely ridiculous, right? I mean, if you want to install an application, back in the early days of Mac OS, you would drag the application off the floppy onto your hard disk and you'd be done. That's it. But nowadays, you know, Photoshop installs a whole bunch of files. It puts a little bit of stuff in the preferences folder in the system folder. It puts some other stuff in the system extensions folder and so on and so forth. And on Windows, this is even a bigger nightmare, where you've got a whole bunch of stuff all over the place, and nobody knows what's going on. And in general, it's very difficult to uninstall things, which may or may not be called a feature. But in this case, you just drag the application into the trash can, delete it, and you're done. That's kind of cool. You do the same things with libraries and so on. Multiple users is actually a really deep area where there's all sorts of stuff, and I'm going to kind of gloss over a lot of it. But one of the big problems is this whole idea of security versus ease of use, right? Because in Mac OS, you can set the clock, but in Unix, you need to be root to do that. Well, that's rather shocking to somebody who's used to being able to do that stuff. All of a sudden, there are files on the disk which you can't open. Now, that sort of makes sense if it's, you know, mom's file versus dad's file versus sister's file or whatever. But there's actually files on the disk that belong to the system now, and we don't let you muck around with the system folder anymore. You can't delete the kernel. That would be bad. So we actually have permissions which are designed to prevent you from messing the system up, same as in Unix. But this is a new thing, and it's something we have to educate our users about, and it's something that our applications have to deal with, which they didn't have to do before. So it's a very pervasive issue. You can't just install software anymore, because some of the directories where you install applications are not necessarily writable by you anymore. Fortunately, you can install apps onto your home directory, and this whole idea of drag install is actually really easy to do there. And the other thing is you can't generally move things around. And again, we try to hide the things that you can't move around, like slash bin and slash user. Plus, they're kind of ugly to look at anyway. But this is all new stuff for the user that they need to be educated about. Even though we do, of course, call it a feature, because it is. User IDs were a really hard issue, and we talked about this at length internally, and then I moved the discussion over to the NetBSD and FreeBSD developer list because we wanted their opinion, because this is something where we've actually done a couple of really wacky things, and we didn't want to be too weird, so we wanted some ideas. But basically the problem is this. You've got user IDs stamped on disk, which belong to some notion of users. I'm ID 521 at Apple, W. Sanchez, right? I take that hard disk home where I'm user ID 101. Well, so now you've got this problem. You take a disk, you move from one computer to the other, and the user IDs on that disk may or may not be relevant. They might all be bogus, they might some be bogus, or they might be all okay. And there's really no easy way to tell at all. And plus, what do you do when you find out whether it's one or the other? It's actually a fairly complicated issue and not an easy one to solve, and something we're still sort of hashing out. And the other thing is, if you're like on a net info network, you might actually be able to port the disk around inside of the network because the user IDs are shared across those several systems. So what we've done is we actually keep track of which volumes we know about. So if we sort of trust the IDs on the system, we keep a database of which volumes we've met before, and we sort of know that the IDs are okay. In the case where you discover a foreign disk that you've never met before, you've got to take some action on it. One option is you can just accept the user IDs on there at face value and maybe mark the disk as local. And then from then on it just operates. And this is what Unix always does. Another is you can, and we've actually implemented this, is that you can ignore all the IDs on the disk. In fact, for removable media on Unix, people often use DOS floppies because there's no permissions issues there. And we could use HFS, which has the same sort of non-feature. But what we can do here is just ignore user and group entirely and tag those as unknown, unknown. And we can give whoever the guy is that logged in on the console can have the privileges of user unknown as well as his own. So that way, when you mount a disk, we assume you're the guy at the console that stuck the FireWire drive into the back of the computer. And then you're allowed to sort of access these files willy-nilly without a whole lot of issues. Shown into group just basically don't do anything. I don't think they return errors, but they don't actually do anything. The other option is, well, you've got this disk, you don't know about the user IDs on it, so we're going to just do a shown-r and just scribble a new user and group pair on all the files on the disk. And those could be unknown unknown again, or they could be root.wheel or whatever. And what we're going to have to do here is actually present the user with some UI where they're going to have to choose. And this is actually where it gets really sticky, because this isn't a trivial thing to explain. Right, so how we handle that is still kind of up in the air. Lastly, we'll talk about Classic, which is kind of fun. We've got, several million customers, and we've got several thousand applications that are out there. We want those applications to continue to work. And furthermore, they can't be recompiled in order for that to happen because some of these vendors are gone, or you know, some users just aren't going to necessarily want to go to the store and get another copy of the thing that they've already paid for. So that puts a lot of restrictions on us because we need binary compatibility, which means the Mac toolbox in the context of Classic cannot change. We can tiddle around with Carbon a little bit to make it work on this multi-threaded preemptive system. We could twiddle around a little bit with BSD in order to make it accommodate Mac OS a little better, but we cannot make any changes to the Mac toolbox here. And all these applications are completely unaware of the fact that they're running on Mac OS X. They don't know that there are multiple users on the system. They don't know that there's preemption going on. They don't know that the virtual memory is now this vast thing that is controlled by Mach. So Classic provides an environment where these applications can run. It's basically a sandbox. And in Mac OS, you know, you can have an app that scribbles over the other app's memory. You can have an app that'll crash and cause the system to need to be rebooted. In this case, what'll happen is other Classic apps might be vulnerable. The Classic environment might crash. But Mac OS X will be relatively invulnerable to all of this stuff because Classic crashing is just an application like any other, and it's not a big deal. Just a Unix process, after all. One interesting thing is Classic actually runs stock Mac OS 9. It's not a changed version of Mac OS 9. It's actually the same thing that we ship on hardware as Mac OS 9. The number of changes that happen when you run Classic for the first time are really, really minor. There's an enabler that's installed that sort of replaces the hardware abstraction layer so that it thinks that Mac OS 10 is hardware. There's also a change to the TCP/IP control panel, which makes it just display your IP address rather than let you change it because that's owned by Mac OS 10 now. A couple little nits like that, but really nothing major. What Classic does is it shims low-level Mac OS system calls over to the Mac OS 10 side. To a first approximation, what we do is just replace the hardware abstraction layer. So Mac OS X's kernel is a piece of hardware that Mac OS 9 is running on top of. And then you can sort of work your way up the stack, and I'm going to demonstrate that here with the picture. So say you've got a hard disk over on the Mac OS X side, and you've got applications that access it via the chain depicted there. On the Classic side, you've got an application, it talks to the file system, it talks to the disk driver, it talks to the SCSI driver, and then all of a sudden it's stuck because there's no disk over on that side. So what we do the first time is we have the SCSI driver on the Mac OS 10 side, 9 side, shimmed over to the SCSI driver on the Mac OS 10 side. Now this is an exclusive access because you can't have two sort of SCSI events going on at the same time asynchronously. So that disconnects Mac OS 10. So this is a sort of an exclusive mode disk where you can have this disk is being used by Mac OS 9, this disk is being used by Mac OS 10, and they can unmount and let the other guy mount it, and you can sort of share files, but not really. So this is obviously suboptimal, better than nothing, but it's certainly not ideal. So let's move up a little bit. Let's say that we're going to instead disable this SCSI driver on Mac OS 9, and the disk driver is going to talk to a file that's in the file system on Mac OS 10. Now the whole Mac OS 10 stack is working as before. We've got a disk image, which is being stored on any file system in Mac OS 10. This is kind of cool because it could be on a UFS or NFS volume as well as HFS Plus. But it's still this opaque thing, so you're not really sharing files because you can't open a file in the disk image from the Mac OS 10 side. But it does enable a lot more software to run. One of the things that breaks here is Apple's drive setup program, which talks directly to the SCSI driver, lets you partition disks and so on. That's broken now because you can't go straight down to that level anymore. Next option is to have the disk driver shimmed to the other disk driver. That gives you a little more flexibility in terms of devices because you don't have to worry about every different kind of SCSI device. So you support more drives that way. But once again, Mac OS X applications are unhappy about this. Next level up is to have a Mac OS X file system talk to nine file system talk to the 10 file system. And this is actually a pretty happy little arrangement, which we call the shared file system. Applications work on both sides. We've broken a new class of applications now. Norton Disk Doctor can't work because it talks to the disk driver. But, you know, there aren't very many of those applications, and this actually works for almost everything else. And in this case, we've got Microsoft PowerPoint running on Mac OS 9, which is actually talking to files that are stored on on the Mac OS X system. Another example is USB device access. It's a very similar situation. You've got a mouse on the bottom. Mac OS X owns it. You can shim the driver across. That's, again, exclusive. Or in this case, you can have the input sprocket talk to the HID manager, and it turns out that you can share that and multiplex events so that everybody's happy here. And so there's a whole bunch of different examples of this for different sorts of devices. And we basically always start at the bottom. We have an exclusive driver-to-driver mapping. And then you work your way up the chain as you can. One of the interesting things is that you can actually get away with working up the chain because there aren't very many applications that talk to the bottom. And that's largely due to the fact that it's been a closed architecture for so long. Amazingly enough, that turns out to have been a good thing in this case, because the hardware, which Apple's always made, has always been sort of closed hardware, and it's been very well abstracted as a result by the software. And we've always encouraged our developers to use the highest level API available. If you're going to write to the screen, you're going to use QuickDraw, because if you talk directly to some driver, you're going to break in the next version of the Mac OS, or you're going to break when we ship new hardware. So pretty much everybody talks to the high-level APIs in the system. And as a result, you can shim down lower-level things, and not very many things are going to break as a result. There's a whole pile of other problem areas that I won't go into here, but I'll give you some ideas. Like, there's a whole notion of, like, what's root? Never heard of that. And sort of access control models and so on in the system. In Mac OS X, it's pretty likely we're not going to have any sort of way to log in as root by default. If you're clever enough, you could probably turn that back on. But users need to have some way of being able to administer the machine without having to log in as the root user. And this is sort of a fundamental thing that Unix needs to address anyway, is have a better mechanism for allowing users to administer their machines without having sort of the big mother switch that lets them do anything. Networking had some really cool issues with it. I didn't have a whole lot of time to talk to Justin about it, but there's a Y adapter in the networking stack in the kernel that actually multiplexes out incoming packets so that they either go to Classic or to Mac OS X, you can share an IP address. We don't actually have to do NAT, which is something that we thought we would have to do. There's a bunch of security issues with networking. We ship with everything turned off by default. We do have an inetd.conf. Everything's commented out. We don't enable Finger. We don't enable Telnet. We don't enable any of the things that Unix systems, for some reason, still enable by default. And it's something that was a big criticism of choosing a Unix core under Mac OS, because Mac OS is, to some degree, considered very secure in the fact that there aren't these features to exploit there. You can get a hold of me if you want more information. I'm wsanchez@apple.com. I wrote up a paper summarizing this stuff. The URL is www.mit.edu/people/wsanchez/papers/unix_2000, all caps, Usenix. And you can get a lot more information about Mac OS X on apple.com/macOS10, and plenty of information about Darwin, including the source code to the core OS, and, on apple.com/Darwin. So if people have any questions, I'm for a game now. Thanks. You want to go up to the microphones if you have questions, and then identify yourself and the company you're with so that we know who we're talking
to. Yeah, actually, can you go back one slide so that people can see those URLs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Brent Chapman, I've got two questions. First, have you guys thought any about the security holes that are going to be caused by all of those odd characters in file names when all of the existing shell scripts and Perl scripts and things like that get a hold of them? I mean, that kind of handling has been the source of a lot of security holes in packages
right.
today.
Most of the software in Mac OS X that we're interested in is actually Carbon software or Cocoa software and not really very shell script centric. The Unix guys are a little bit out on their own in Mac OS X. So if you're developing Unix stuff and you're writing shell scripts, it's sort of seen as your responsibility for addressing these sort of flaws that exist in Mac OS or in Unix's handling of funny characters and so on. We're going to make every effort to make sure that anything we ship doesn't have these problems. But if you're a third party and you're developing stuff and you're porting it to Mac OS X, you should be aware of these problems. In fact, you should be aware of these problems on any Unix system, though. It's a very, very, very common problem in CGI programs on the web where people just assume that people are going to type ?query=something reasonable, and they get back garbage, and all of a sudden the shell that they're parsing their CGI with is giving them all sorts of security grief. So this is actually a common problem in Unix, which needs to be addressed on a larger scale, and maybe macOS will help address that a little bit.
Okay. Second question is there any way of using environment variables or anything like that to control the behavior of some of the stuff you were talking about? For instance, how data and resource forks are handled. You know, let's say I do want to run a tar and I do want it to create Apple double files. Can I set an environment variable or anything like that and just, you know, make it do that for the rest of that session?
One of the things we talked about is I think there's a function you can call in Windows that'll set the text mode so that when you open files, it'll either do new line translation or not. And so we can sort of do something in a program where we can give you an API to switch whether you want by default to get some sort of encoded full contents of the file or whether you want to get just a data fork. We haven't explored that fully. For the most part, our current status is that in the Unix side and at the BSD command line, we don't support much handling of complex files. We don't support file creator and file ID stuff. And we're trying to discourage our developers from continuing to use those things in order to increase the portability of the system to other file systems and so on.
Okay, thank you.
That's it. Yossi Silverman. Can we run X instead of Aqua?
You can. There's an export to IOKit that'll take over the screen, and in theory that could be written so that you can run a rootless X server inside of Quartz. My opinion, and I believe Apple's opinion, is that that's the wrong thing for Apple to do. We're already supporting a lot of API options. Carbon and Cocoa are some excellent APIs, and we'd really rather see you use Quartz. So I think it would be a bad idea for Apple to, say, ship an X11 server with macOS 10 because we don't want people using that. It also doesn't conform to the Aqua guidelines at all because the behavior's funny or you get that weird color map thing. Certainly it's something that a third party could do, and we wouldn't discourage that.
Question two, file name /all to get everything. I mean, sort of repeating his question, but at least...
to get an encoded version? Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
So just so when you do a CP, you can get everything.
Yeah.
Third question, mapping symbolic usernames when importing a disk into UIDs. I would have to assume there'd be some sort of.
Well, I mean, you run into a problem no matter what, right? Because W. Sanchez on an Apple computer might not be W. Sanchez on a different computer. So no matter what you do, I mean, there's flaws in the scheme. I mean, you need some sort of global unique identifier, and you know, you could do sort of really evil things. Oh, we'll use your social security number, but you know, you don't want to get into that business, and it's very difficult to implement. So I mean, no matter what solution you come up with, when you move a disk from one computer to the other, I think there's some really difficult problems there. If you've got some really interesting ideas there, I'd love to hear about them offline. But you know, we haven't really thought of any really, really clever things there.
Final question was Aqua or, I guess, Quartz under Solaris under Linux?
Oh, not bloody likely.
Thanks.
That's, like, considered a very, very valuable asset. It's got some really cool stuff there. I've used it. It's actually really cool. And I don't think we're ready to be giving that away yet.
John Cole, Rational Software. That kind of leads into one of my questions is, are you doing any sort of market development outreach to companies that provide Unix products to try and get them to port things to Macintosh where it makes sense?
Well, one of the great things about macOS is that it's got a lot of potential to open up a lot of new markets for us. Certainly, there's a lot of existing software that is much easier to port to macOS 10 than it was to previous versions of macOS. And one example of that is at WWDC, we actually had demonstrated a port of Maya, which is, I don't know if you're in the graphics business, but it's this great 3D modeling stuff that's used by ILM and other places to do high-end computer graphics stuff. And that's mostly written to Unix. And it runs on SGIs, and they actually ported it because we've got OpenGL and we've got a Unix backend in the system rather easily. And the same stuff, I've gotten calls from Pixar and ILM porting their applications over because they're very Unix-centric. So there are a lot of vendors that are already sort of moving to macOS because they couldn't before, And in those cases, in particular, since we're very strong in the content market, are very important to Apple. But certainly there's a lot of interesting things that Apple hasn't really been able to explore before, like enterprise solutions and server software and so on, where that's not presently our market, but certainly there's a lot of potential to grow into some new roles.
Are there some contacts that ISVs could talk to, or should this look through, the web pages that Apple Corporate has have something about that?
I believe if you go to the Apple Developer Connection, which is developer.apple.com, or it's apple.com/developer, you can get information about how to become a developer. And actually, we're being very open. We've got a lot of, we've inherited a lot of sort of new kinds of developers from Next as well. And so we've got a lot of people in place now in the Worldwide Developer Relations group that handle new sorts of developers, and I think they'd be more than excited to talk to people who haven't talked to us before.
All right, thanks.
Hi, Nick Sayre from Enlightened Software. Something just caught my ear as I was listening going by. You said you were going to make it more difficult to to log in as root in the final release.
Yeah.
Does this mean that you're backing away from including a terminal or a command line in the final product?
It's not clear whether a terminal will exist in Mac OS X per se. There's sort of two arguments. One is, well, it's functionality, why take it out? The other is, well, it's a crutch, and we don't want our developers having their tech support staff telling our users, okay, I launched a terminal program, etc, rrc, blah, blah, I hope he knows how to use Emacs. That's not going to fly with our customers. So there's a strong argument for making access to that level of the system hard just so that we could discourage our developers from doing it. It's not clear which argument's going to win out. I think the terminal app is going to be an option. It might not be installed by default, but I think it's going to be likely that it'll be on the CD and you could install it. And if not, we might stick it in Darwin or something where people can get to it.
Thank you.
Hi. Actually, my problem was real similar to that, but I have strong objections to your removing root access easily and certainly to the terminal program. Those are really, really important if you're trying to administer a Mac and you're dealing with Mac people. It's cool if you don't want Mac people to have quick access, but you should at least leave the terminal program easy access to the root administrator who should be able to log into the machine.
Well, I mean, most of the administration things that require root are sort of command line oriented things. We're moving towards being able to give users the ability to do that sort of thing without logging in as root. I think that's a better way to go about it. If you really, really want root, you will be able to turn it back on. Basically, it's just going to be we're going to star out the password, and so there won't be a password associated with the root user anymore. He'll still exist, and you'll have to set the password if you want to be able to log in as root, which won't be something that set up a system will give you as an option, but you could probably find a way to do it anyway. I'm logged in as root right now, so I hear you.
A technical question and then a more philosophical one. You said early in the talk you talked about the resource fork and how that's handled, and then later on you said in Mac OS X that the resource fork is not being used.
What we're doing is we have to handle it because existing programs use it.
But would you say it's fair to say it's been deprecated?
It's being discouraged at the very least. I don't know if we could say deprecated, but we do want to support, our applications should work on UFS, and they're not going to work on UFS if they depend on resource forks being there. So to that degree, yeah, they're strongly discouraged.
And the previous two questions and your responses have reminded me strongly of the first Windows NT and Lisa NT conference where Microsoft was telling us that, well, you can do all the things that you can do in administering Unix with our GUIs. And we were saying, yes, but when we're administering a large set of machines, system administration practice does not allow for GUIs. And I think that I come from a similar situation as a lot of people that I've talked to here, and that is that I started on the Mac, and then because I liked the power that I had over the machine, I felt like I understood it was clean, and then eventually as time went on, it got less so, and I switched to Unix because I felt like I again had control of the machine, and I hope that you it seems like you have an opportunity to bring that back, and
sure.
It would be very nice.
And certainly we intend to make that as possible as we can. It's just, you know, the argument, of course, is that you shouldn't have to ever do that. And that's a very important thing for us because our customers don't want to have to do that. Now, we have customers that want to be able to do that, and there's no reason why we should prevent that. And, in fact, you know, our server customers, we sell Mac OS X Server as a web platform or as a NetBoot platform. You know, they tend to want that. And I administer the Darwin CVS server, and I do that via SSH, right? More important for us than that is to actually deliver on the, yes, you can actually do this all with the GUI. And that doesn't necessarily mean restricting you to it, but it means that we do need to actually make that work. And we have solutions. We have, like, actually some really good admin UI for the Unix stuff, although it's certainly not complete and not as flexible as doing it by editing Apache.conf or whatever. And we've got a NetBoot solution where you could actually have a cluster of machines that you can netboot off of another machine and administer all centrally via one mechanism, sort of in the network computer style. And that's actually a cool way to administer a large number of machines. And it's working actually very well for a lot of our educational customers. So, I mean, those are the solutions we're pursuing. But, of course, the mechanisms already exist in the Unix world, so we don't see that going away.
Well, you have no idea how many system administrators would like to be able to administer the graphic designs department's Macs with a Perl script, right?
Sure, but you know, we also have AppleScript, and we find that our publishing customers are really loving that because they can actually do remote AppleScript now, and they can actually script the whole pile of machines and control all their UI applications remotely that way. So, I mean, yeah, we want to keep as much functionality there as we can, but we also want to add the ability to do that in a much friendlier way than is traditionally possible in Unix.
My name is Randy Shimizu. I'm with Guerrilla Computer Solutions here in San Diego. And I had several questions for you. In the Aqua interface, has Macintosh preserved the object-based functionalities that was in the Next Step interface?
Are you talking about programming interface?
No, more of the different types of drag and drop capabilities they have to build applications.
Well, I mean, you know, we have that same toolbox, and not all of the cool magic in Next Step works in Carbon, but it does all work in Cocoa. And in fact, the Cocoa text system is like one of the most phenomenal bits of engineering I've ever seen, and plus it has Emacs key bindings, which makes me grin. But you know, and every app, every text field, everywhere, you can control A and control E, and it's really cool. But, and all the drag and drop and services functionality is there. We haven't extended all of that functionality over to Carbon, which is something we're hoping to do. And likewise, Carbon has a whole bunch of neat things that macOS had, which Next never did, and so we're trying to bridge that over as well so that you could do things like QuickTime from the object-oriented APIs and so on.
And the other question was, what kernel version of Mach are you guys currently using, 2.5? Or
we're using Mach 3.0. We worked with the OSF for many years in working with NK Linux and so on. So we did a lot of the Mach research in conjunction with the OSF, and they did that work under contract, so we own it. And so it's a Mach 3.0 plus BSD kernel.
Okay, thank you.
John Kolbashal, Software. A couple of questions regarding the classic interface. Do you still support 68K binaries? I don't remember if that's even in Mac OS 9, but does...
I believe the answer is yes. It does the same system-level emulation that it did in Mac OS 9.
And regarding the split stack for the multiplexing the IP address between classic and everything else, can classic applications connect through the network to the rest of Mac OS as a server?
Sure, you can run a web server on the 10 side and then connect to it from the 9 side.
Great. And finally...
It's actually very important because Doom needs that.
And what's the support for Unicode, if any? And is it sort of
Unicode is very pervasive everywhere in the system. All of the high-level APIs are fundamentally Unicode, especially on the Cocoa side. And in fact, at the kernel level, all file names and so on are treated as UTF-8. So, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. For file names?
The question is, what was the native encoding? Is it all UTF-8?
Well, at the BSD level, it's UTF-8. In the higher level APIs like Carbon, the core foundation string classes, which I think you can check out in Darwin, although it doesn't have quite all of the text encodings, has a lot of options for encoding into various ISO or kanji this and that and the other. So I'm not an expert on that stuff, but I do know we have a very, very flexible text system all throughout the system, and Unicode is a first-class citizen everywhere.
Hi. Is there any support for setting the creator and type information on a file from the terminal?
I know it would be pretty easy to write a Carbon-based command line thing that does it, and we've got them on the developer package. I don't know if it's available on the base system or not. It certainly could be done. The API you want is in sys/adder.h, which is the new header we added for getting at file attributes and so on. And you could do it at the BSD library layer and not at the Carbon layer if you want to. So you could, and that would be the right thing if CP were to become smart and read resource ports, it would do it there.
Thanks. David Oppenheimer, UC Berkeley. About 5 years ago, Apple came out with a product called MAE, Macintosh Application Environment, and I was wondering if there were any lessons that you learned from that experience that you were able to apply to Mac OS 10.
Oh, absolutely.
10, and if so,
MAE, that very same team of people are the guys that write Classic. It's exactly the same engineering staff. And they know, those are very smart guys. And they know how to do like funny things like binary emulation on the fly and so on and so forth. And they've done some, I mean, the fact that Classic works at all is just a phenomenal achievement, I think. And in fact, it works better on Mach than it does just straight Mac OS 9 in a lot of regards. So, I mean, they've done some really, really great stuff of actually making Mac OS really think that it's running on really cool hardware with a gigabyte of RAM always and so on and so forth. And we talk to them a lot about ideas on how to do similar things elsewhere in the system. They're a very, very good bunch of guys.
John Callist, Counterpain. I don't have a question, but I have a couple of comments because I'm a Mac developer for many years and also a Unix developer for many years. And I'm looking forward to OS X as being potentially one of the coolest Unix workstations around. So please let us get things like the terminal. If it's an install option, that's great. That's perfect. But we do need to be able to use Perl. I mean, on a lot of levels, AppleScript is in fact better than Perl. But that doesn't matter. There's a whole lot of Perl around, and I use it all the time. And right now, I do Unix things and Mac things on the same laptop by running Unix under virtual PC, which is kind of kludgy, but, an emulated x86 runs fast enough for command line. And having that all be native on my Mac, where I can do all the Unix stuff that I need to do and all the Mac stuff that I want to do, would be absolutely the best environment. And I know a lot of people who are just waiting for OS X to come around to buy themselves a PowerBook. So please do that.
So I mean I'm square in the center of your camp. I run many terminal windows on my machine at home and at work. One of the things I did when I started at Apple and we were working on Rhapsody was NextStep had a lot of annoying things about its Unix in that it was sort of halfway in a lot of ways. And I just started ripping stuff out, added a better shell, Perl is now built in. So on and so forth. And there's a lot of work that I've put into making the Unix subsystem a lot better. And I didn't do that because nobody's going to ever use it. So it's going to be there. Perl is standard part of the system now. And in fact, there's some neat things you can do now, because one of the other talks I give a lot at Apple conferences and so on is that you can actually take all this BSD stuff, which is great stuff, and you know it traditionally has some like nasty UI, but you can very easily using Cocoa wrap that up in a nice little bundle and write cool applications with very little effort, because you can just port something that already works in Unix. And one example I did last month at our developers conference was I wrote a little app that you can take any script, a Perl script, a shell script, or whatever, drag it onto this application, and it'll create a Cocoa application that'll just run whatever script you dragged on there on whatever files you drag on this new application. And one of the cool features of Mac Perl is that you can actually drag and drop files onto the Mac Perl scripts and have it process those files for you in some neat way. So now you can actually just do that very trivially by just dragging onto your Perl script your files and just having your Perl script in that way do neat things for you. And you could, in that sense, take something that's relatively arcane and present it in a way that's actually pretty amenable to our user base. So there's a lot of great potential for making Unix stuff a lot more user-friendly. Certainly there's a lot of work going on in the Unix world already with things like GNOME and so on, but I think we're a bit ahead of the curve there. So, I think there's going to be a lot of fun things to do with Mac OS X for the Unix world.
Well, please continue to do that. And there are many things that you could do that would be good enough. I mean, for example, there are GNOME apps that I want to run, so that means that I need an X server, and as long as there's a package that I can install the free X server on my system and poof, there it works, I'm willing to live with
but
all
even
of
even better yet would be for somebody to run to port the API to talk to Quartz.
That
and then you just rebuild your thing and it runs in the native environment with the nice everything else that comes with it.
That would also be acceptable.
And,
I mean, but
GTK runs on Macintosh. It runs on Mac Classic, right? So, I mean, you'd have to re-report it because we have a very different display layer, but that would be cool.
Okay, well, thanks.
Hi, Andrew Lumsdaine, Lawrence Berkeley Lab. Just to follow up on this last thing, it'd be really nice if Apple could provide some single place of contact to actually download some of these tools and so forth, well-known Unix tools from my own place. It took me personally quite some time, for instance, just to get SSH working under Mac OS X myself.
There's two things we can do there. One is we include most of the popular things in the system, so you don't have to like build your own Perl because it comes there. In fact, we try to keep it current and everything. SSH is another thing that as soon as I get it to work, Jordan apparently got it to work a lot more easily than I did. As soon as that's working, that'll be bundled in the system as well. And I'm, like the OpenBSD guys, I'm all for like killing Telnet off.
www.stepwise.com, which are a bunch of OpenStep and NetStep developers.
Yeah, but that's right. That's the Finland SSH. I'm talking about OpenSSH because we can't, we can't deal with nasty license.
But a lot of Unix applications are starting to show up.
Right.
People are porting forward to.
Right. So one resource for you is stepwise.com. They have a thing called SoftTrack there where they keep track of upcoming software, things that people have ported. But, another thing we could do is in the Darwin space is to build up a ports collection in the sense that FreeBSD has done. That's a great example of a way to really make it easy for our users to get things just working magically. And, in fact, we could even wrap that up in a nice little UI. You click a little button, go get me SSH. It'll download it, build it for you, install it, and then you're
exactly.
done.
Yeah, I mean, that would just unleash.
Sure. One of the other things we're doing is, one of the things we'd like to do, unfortunately we're very short-staffed and we have a lot of things to deal with, is to get a really, really great packaging system set up so that you could actually just have things that are pre-built in the sense that Debian does it, where you can just download whatever you want and it'll get the dependencies right and so on. And you can just upgrade your system dynamically on the fly at any time. So, I mean, there's a lot of neat things we could do. They probably won't be done for version 1 or
sure.
10.0, but...
Well, here's my actual question. Okay. There's been rumors on the web and so forth that Darwin can successfully be ported to other architectures, non-PowerPC.
It runs on Intel today.
Okay, so what about the other layers on top of, that you showed on your slide, on top of Darwin?
You will not see those on Intel today.
Will we see them on Intel tomorrow?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
But one of the interesting things you could do is like port to like IBM's PowerPC hardware. And in theory, if you have a license to macOS 10, you can get the whole stack working there. That'd be kind of fun. Intel is, you know, we like the Intel's important for the Darwin space because it's important in the open source context. It's also important in that, you know, it's good for the system to be platform agile. And that doesn't mean that we intend to ever work on Intel or anything. But I don't know if you remember the PowerPC transition from 68K. That was actually pretty brutal. And basically what it came down to, macOS 8.5 was the first version that had AppleScript running PowerPC native. And that was years after the PowerPC transition. It's basically because there was a lot of assumptions ingrained into the API at a very fundamental level. Another one of these sort of barnacles that we've built up in that revolved around the 68K architecture and assumed that you had that processor there. And when we switched to PowerPC, it was just really hard to rewrite all the software that had that. So it's very important, you know, in our sense, for at least the core OS, not to assume things like endianness, not to assume things like what the chip can or cannot do, and remain platform agile. So the next time Motorola comes out with the new great chip, we'll be able to like adopt it a lot more easily.
Okay, Steve Byan from Quantum. Just curious, maybe you could address something about any kind of power management features that are going to be in macOS 10 beta, and wondering what kind of battery life you get on your PowerBook there.
Well, in macOS 10 you get pretty abysmal battery life right now. But actually that's one of the really, really interesting problem spaces because, you know, when you put a Unix system to sleep, what's that all mean, right? Because there's a lot of things that are going on which don't expect to necessarily be interrupted in that particular way, or you know, can the kernel handle being put to sleep? So there are a lot of power management issues. Most of those are being dealt with by the IOKit team. So they have in their, you know, IOKit's sort of an object-oriented driver model, and they've got a notion of power planes, and you can disable the PCI bus and this, that, and the other, and things can notify everyone else that, oh, I'm going to sleep. And there's a lot of like little details that they're addressing all over the place. And then above that, you have to deal with how the networking stack is going to respond to an incoming packet when the system's asleep. Well, that's a kind of a hard thing to do. And sometimes you need hardware support for that. But, I mean, some of these things are actually mandated by Energy Star, which is actually a critical certification for Apple to have. So, you know, we're there. We're looking. We're working real hard. We've got some power management there now. Our displays, you know, go to sleep and so on. And I don't know if we can put the power processor to sleep yet successfully, but being worked on very actively.
Todd Lewis of SecureWorks. I had a comment and then a question. The first comment was, did I hear you right during the Unlink discussion? I mean, you said you are looking at dpackage. Do you have it running?
I use dpackage to build Darwin. So, you know, whenever we build something, we install a bunch of packages into a root environment using dpackage, and then I build in there. And it's included in there, but we don't include the specs, and we don't really use it right now. One of the things we're investigating is whether that was the right decision. Maybe we should use package-add from FreeBSD so that we're at least consistent with the BSD world. Dpackage has the rather fatal property that it's GPL'd, which means that we can't easily use it in macOS 10 without being extremely careful about what it taints. And that GPL licensing tends to really spoil a lot of otherwise good apples for us. But okay.
For what it's worth,
I get it.
For what it's worth, we used dpackage at Mindspring for years to manage all of our server software, and it served us really, really well.
The reason we actually picked dpackage is because Cle Dinas sits right next to me.
The dependency model is just beautiful, for one.
Yeah, well, one of the guys who maintained it sits right next to me at Apple. He's a big Debian guy, Cle Dinas. And he maintains GDB for macOS 10. And so he got it set up for me, and so that's why we're using it now. I don't know how the FreeBSD thing measures up the dpackage. I don't know.
With apps' ability to do, you know, source compilation,
right.
Recently, to my mind, it ranks right up there with user ports on that front. So I just wanted to give that plug. We're actually hosting a dpackage developers conference in Atlanta in mid-July. I don't know if you guys might be interested in
I mean, you know, packaging is something that we're still trying to figure out, and it's a fairly hard problem, I think. And, you know, it'd be great if we could use dpackage. The GPL thing is a big one, though. So
well, you're not linking it against anything. I don't know how it'd be.
No, but if our installer uses it, then maybe we have to open source the installer, which they may or may not be willing to do.
As long as you're executing some as a separate executable, it's not tainting.
Not necessarily. Actually, I've been exchanging a lot of email with Richard lately. If I say, for example, made binsh bash, does that mean that the entire operating system, which depends on sh, does that make it a derivative work? His reply was yes, believe it or not. And that's somewhat inconsistent with the normal FSF position of linking against it. But all of this is arbitrary.
It's also consistent with Stallman's policy of being an asshole whenever possible. I mean, it doesn't make it true.
But it doesn't matter. The point is that the license doesn't specify. We don't know. We can't make any assumptions at it. And our lawyers are going to kick my butt if I do something stupid like that.
Sure. I think the Debian guys would definitely be open to working with you on that.
Yeah, so I mean, if they're willing to do a BSD license type thing, or at least something less, you know, or something that at least makes a very clear notion of what derivative work is.
I'm sure they'd be happy to give you clarification, I mean, if nothing else. So.
Right.
The second question was in terms of the issues that you were visiting in terms of interface and rich file names and these sort of latent issues that have always been there in Unix that you guys are bringing to the front. I mean, the GNOME and KDE guys have to deal with that as well. I was wondering what thoughts you have given to working with those projects to perhaps, you know, pull efforts and political willpower to try to give the Unix community a collective kick in the ass to try to, you know, start working through some of those problems.
I went to the GNOME talk yesterday, and there was some neat stuff that they're doing. That GNOME VFS, for example, does at least a couple of really interesting things that maybe we could learn from. I mean, GNOME has the same fatal problem that dpackage does. Right, so
yeah, I mean, not necessarily in terms of code sharing, but in terms of identifying these issues and problems with you know, Unix conventions and the archaicness. And you know, I think they'd also be probably willing to
work. I mean, the funny thing is that, you know, HFS Plus actually got a lot of things right, in that having a resource fork actually makes a lot of things a lot easier. Unfortunately, it's not standard, and that makes it really hard, especially now in the day of the Internet, where you want to transfer files around, and now you have to encode them all and decode them as you move them around. So, we're sort of reinventing that space in some ways, and we could probably share more ideas with the community on that.
Sure. I mean,
and you know, that's one of the goals of Darwin is, you know, it's not so much to, you know, there's a lot of people who think they know what Apple's motives are in regards to open source, but, you know, fundamentally it's, we've decided open standards are a good thing, we've learned that lesson, and sharing source code is a good way to keep that honest. And it turns out it's actually a great way to work better with some of the community players like FreeBSD and Apache, which we work very closely with and really value. So, you know, working with the GNOME guys is certainly a good idea, even if we end up not being able to share code, which is unfortunate.
Sure. This is great work. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Howie Kay from Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. Two quick questions. One, the Mac X server, will it work with this at all?
Mac X, I tried it on 9 once and it didn't make me happy. So I don't know. You know, I mean, it's no longer a supported product, so I don't know what the state of it is. I'd rather use a native port, right? So, and it's not that much work. One of the sort of weirdnesses about open source is everyone has wish lists and not everybody contributes. So, you know, I mean, if you really want X11, put in the time, because that.
The other one, what is performance like on Mac OS 10 versus 9?
In a lot of areas, it's a lot better. In certain areas, actually, we got a lot of complaints from the QuickTime guys because, you know, Mac OS 9, because the scheduler is cooperative, they can actually just take over the CPU. And that's really excellent for their performance, right? But, you know, it's actually a legitimate issue because if you've got real-time data you're trying to display, you know, and it's you know, like that Star Wars trailer takes some computrons to make happen. You know, in Unix you don't necessarily get any guarantees of service that way. And so, you know, things like real-time support help that. But our performance is pretty good, I think. DP3 was pretty abysmal. DP4 is leaves a lot to be desired, which is what we're using now. So we've got a lot of room for improvement. I was talking to somebody from Pixar yesterday, and he was telling me that Linux VPC was doing a little bit better at RenderMan than macOS 10 was. But then, you know, we haven't really dived into the performance issues yet. We haven't optimized a bunch of things. We haven't hardware accelerated this and that yet. So there's a lot of things that we can do to make things better. But I think our story is starting to shape up, and we're not too bad. Certainly our hardware is pretty good. So now the software needs to sort of, you know, catch up.
What about under Classic? Do programs run comparably under Classic to natively now?
Classic apps tend to run as well or better. They get a lot more memory assigned to them, so that makes them happier. And the VM's a lot faster. So they tend to work rather well.
Thanks.
It's not an emulation environment, so it's not, there's no real performance hit in terms of executing the actual binaries.
Dylan Northrop, Integratus. Have you thought of, I know there's been a lot of talk here by a lot of the attendees about I need to have a terminal, and you're saying that there's a lot of old Mac Classic folks who don't care to have a terminal and don't want to have that cluttering up, you know, what is otherwise their nice clean system. Has there been any thought to having roles for the users based on, you know, group membership or some such, so that, you know, somebody who is a part of the power users group would be able to have a terminal and be able to, you know, look at the files that you try to hide away in user and bin and sys and all that, maybe not necessarily modify them, but be able to look at them and reference them, and have a, you know, classic users or you know, sales group that you know, just has the pretty pictures and such.
I mean, we do intend to have some sort of group access control management for admin privileges. The terminal window, if it's there, everyone gets to see it. So, I mean, and again, that's very likely to be at least an install option, if not a standard part of the base system. There are actually people who are strongly, senior people, who are strongly advocating leaving it in the base system. So it might actually just be there.
Well, I mean, other things like when you mount an HFS partition from someplace else or an HFS plus partition, determining which of those three models that you use, whether or not you use the, you know, based on what role they actually have and what group they're part of.
So one of the things that NextStep had and macOS 10 Server has is sort of a Unix expert checkbox in preferences, so you could see the whole file system. You can see /temp, you can see /user, things like that. And so various apps would change their model a little bit based on whether you were declaring yourself a Unix expert or not. We had to rename that because Unix is a trademark. But, so it's just called expert mode. But Finder in macOS 10, and it's not clear whether that's necessarily the right model, but certainly there is demand for it. I, being one of the people who really wish I can get to certain places via the Finder that I currently cannot. So, and all of this is all work in progress, so we'll probably figure something reasonable out, I hope.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gary Driggs from Electric Lightwave, and I was wondering if there were any firewall intrusion detection system or other network security vendors that have expressed an interest in porting to Mac OS X?
I don't know offhand. There's a website that's either macsec.org or macsecurity.org, and they've gotten very interested in Mac OS X, and they've been porting a lot of various sort of security tools to Mac OS X for Unix administrators. So they're pretty involved in that area. I don't know directly how many other things are going on there. We don't have any sort of firewalling product at Apple, so I don't know of anything else. Certainly, if it exists in open source, it's generally pretty easy to get it to work.
What was the website again?
I think it's macsecurity.org.
Thank you.
That's the kind of it.